You bet your ass. But first, I had to get through a dinner with the director and my co-star's brother. I showed up the next night at Citrus on Melrose. Back then, this was the Hollywood restaurant. Expensive, exclusive, jacket required, and a line of paparazzi at the door clicking away madly at everyone who came and went. That night, the comings and goings were me. The film's director, Jonathan Lynn, a short, round British man who'd made My Cousin Vinny, and who just happened to be Oliver Sacks' cousin, and one of the film's producers, Bruce's brother, David. David got the hair, by the way, Bruce got the chin. I had donned the requisite movie star black suit for the dinner. I'd arrived a minute or two late, just because that's what movie stars do. The dinner went really well, even if no one touched their food, in the standard Hollywood way. Jonathan was very smart and funny. He had that dry, British approach to humor, in which he'd say something that was seemingly serious, but there would be a twinkle in his eye, just enough to signal that he was busting balls. David was attentive and interesting and smart. As for me, well, I had already decided to do the movie. The original script had no physical comedy in it, so I said things like, I think this would be a great opportunity for some physical comedy, and I'd be more than willing to fall down a flight of stairs and leap down some mountaintops to work with Bruce Willis. Jonathan and David laughed and seemed relieved. Eventually, the dinner wrapped up. Jonathan said, well, you're our guy. We really want you to do this. Hands shaken, paparazzi ignored, I jumped into my forest green Porsche and squealed away. I'm going to be the lead in a Bruce Willis movie, I thought, as again all the lights on Sunset were green. Back at my house on Carla Ridge, the moon had come up, lonely, mournful, casting a strange and awkward shadow across my view. I put on the TV, poured a vodka tonic, and waited. The stars were lining up again. Had the rise and rise of Matthew Perry just taken yet another giant leap forward? This is what I thought as the actual stars rose in a clear, dark sky. I started to count them, even though I knew the superstition that once you reach 100, you die. I stopped at 99, just in case. The following morning, I got a message on my answering machine. Matthew, this is Bruce Willis. Call me back or I'll burn your house down and break both your knees and arms and you'll be left with just stubs for hands and feet for the rest of your life. Click, dial tone. I figured this was a call I should probably return. A few days later, we met at Ago, yet another fancy Italian restaurant in Hollywood. In the private room in the back, the one that's reserved for people of Mr. Willis's status, once again, I jetted up in my Porsche, barely putting it in park long enough to hand the valet my keys. But this night, I was on time. Bruce Willis did not disappoint. He oozed A-list. He didn't just take over a room, he was the room. In fact, I knew he was a real movie star when the first thing he did was teach the bartender how to make a perfect vodka tonic. 3 second pour, he said to the petrified man. Bruce was 44 years old, single, separated from Demi Moore at the time I met him, and he knew the exact recipe for the perfect drink. He was a party. To be near him was invigorating. After a while, we were visited in our private little room by Joe Pesci, whom Jonathan Lynn had directed in My Cousin Vinny, as well as several attendant attractive women. Bruce laughed at all my dumb jokes. He seemed to enjoy the spectacle of a younger, funny guy paying him his due respect and keeping up with his drinking, if he only knew. I was thrilled to be around him because he knew how to live life. Dinner once again untouched, the two new best friends headed to his massive house off Mulholland. Bruce, too, seemed to like a view. The night ended with Bruce Willis and Matthew Perry, drinks in hand, hitting golf balls into the San Fernando Valley below. Those balls are going to land somewhere, I thought, and before I could imagine the damage a shot from a well-addressed 5-iron could do or even the metaphorical nature of what we were doing, I stopped thinking at all and had another drink. "Welcome to the pros," Bruce said at one point, referring, I presume, to the life of a movie star, not my golf game. We had begun a friendship, one in which we drank together and made each other laugh and complimented each other's swings. Eventually, as always happens, the sun came up. We said our bleary goodbyes. As I drove home, I remember thinking, watch this guy. This is the way to be happy. Nothing seemed to bother Bruce. No one said no to him. This was indeed the A-Leagues. Around lunchtime that same day, Bruce called me to invite me back to his house for a screening of his next movie. But I was way too sick and hungover to even contemplate showing up. Making my excuses, I asked him what the movie was called so I could catch it later. "The Sixth Sense," he said. So, I'd gotten the whole nine yards and embarked on a friendship with the most famous movie star on the planet. But even I knew I was drinking way too much to pull this movie off. Desperate measures would be needed. Some might be able to party perfectly well and still show up and do the work, but they were not addicts like I was. If I was going to keep up with the partying with Bruce and not go back to my hotel room and keep drinking, then I need something else to wind me down and make sure I could get to the set the next day. I called a friend, I use the term loosely, who I knew sold Xanax. "How many would you like to purchase?" he skeeved at me. "Give me 100, I said. When they arrived, I sat on my bed counting them. This way, I can drink with Bruce and the others, but when I'm finally alone, I can just pop one of these and go to sleep. I may have been a man with a plan, but I was also ignoring the fact that this was a completely lethal combination. We flew on Bruce's plane, of course we did, to Montreal to make the whole nine yards, arriving like conquering heroes, ready to take the town by storm. I was the prodigal Canadian son, now returned, ready to party. We set up shop at the Intercontinental Hotel. I had a regular room. Bruce had the whole top floor, which he immediately dubbed Club Z for no apparent reason. Within hours, he had also had a disco ball installed. The Globe restaurant became our home away from home. The money and the drinks were flowing and the waitresses were hot. Months earlier, I had started dating a woman called Renee. I'd met her at a restaurant in Los Angeles called Red. I was having dinner with the first assistant director of Friends, my pal Ben Weiss, and our waitress came and sat down next to me and started chatting to me. This was not normal waitress behavior, it seemed to me. When she had taken our order, I said to Ben, "Her name is gonna be Samantha." "Nah," he said, "she's definitely a Jennifer." When she came back with our food, I said, "We're having a bet on your name. I have money on Sam, and my friend here thinks you're a Jen." "Hi," she said, "I'm Renee." And somehow, a few drunken parties later, we were a couple. Suffice to say, Renee had substituted for someone who'd broken my heart on an earlier movie, which put her already behind the eight ball. By the time I went to Montreal, we were mostly on the outs, but in any case, and I'm not proud to say this, I would have fucked mud at that stage in my life. Canadian mud, at that. The role itself was a snap. All I had to do was act scared of Bruce, which was easy, and act in love with Natasha Henstridge, which was even easier. The director Jonathan, whom for some unknown reason I had taken to calling Sammy, ran that kind of set I love, a very creative one. The best joke, no matter where it came from, would be picked, just like we did on Friends. Amanda Peet was also in the cast. She was funny and smart and very attractive. And even though she had a boyfriend, she didn't mind flirting, which she did at the drop of a hat with both Bruce and me, to the point where one day Bruce shouted at her, "Pick one!" At night, the parties raged under Bruce's disco ball in Club Z. Somehow, everyone managed to still show up at 6 a.m. for work. I would say somehow, but I know how I did. Those 100 Xanax worked like a charm. Though combined with my drinking, they did tend to make my head resemble a Spalding basketball. Meanwhile, Mr. A-List Willis over there looked like he can open an envelope with his chin. Each day, with me nursing a killer hangover but young enough to deal, we would gather and look at the sides, TV and movie speak for the work slated for the day. We was me, Jonathan Lynn, Bruce Willis, and the hilarious Kevin Pollak, who was playing Yanni Gogolak, another mob boss. It was almost like a writer's room. We'd discuss what might be funny, what might go here in a scene, what might go there. A lot of effort was to add physical comedy for me to do. I would run into windows, slam into doors. At one point, I did a take in which I see a criminal, then turn, run into someone, get knocked back, clatter into a lamp, pick the lamp up, and try to shield myself from the baddie with it. All my idea, all worked great. At one point, Kevin had the line, he shouldn't be able to breathe the air. I suggested to him that he insert an unnaturally long pause before the words, the air. That was about the only time in my career where I could not keep it together. Kevin's performance of that line was so funny, and the pause kept getting longer and longer with each take we did, that in the end, we had to do his coverage with me in a different room. When the veil of Bruce Willis was removed, I just wanted to be his friend. I didn't want to be a suck-up to him like everybody else in the world. At one point, when making the whole nine yards, we had a three-day weekend, and he flew me and Renee and him and his girlfriend to his house in the Turks and Caicos. It's a beautiful place with a stunning view of the ocean. They'd even thought to buy out all the surrounding properties so the paparazzi couldn't get their shots. All weekend, we carried umbrellas with us to block us from the sun so that our faces wouldn't get too tanned and not match for the movie. A new movie star trick, one of many I learned from Mr. Willis. But there was a big difference between Bruce and me. Bruce was a partier. I was an addict. Bruce has an on and off button. He can party like crazy, then get a script like The Sixth Sense and stop the partying and nail the movie sober. He doesn't have the gene. He's not an addict. There are plenty of examples of people in Hollywood who can party and still function. I was not one of them. When I was in my drinking and using days, if a police officer were to come to the door and say, "If you drink tonight, you're going to jail tomorrow," I would start packing for jail, because once I start, I cannot stop. All I had control over was the first drink. After that, all bets were off. See under, the man takes the drink takes all the rest. Once I believe the lie that I can just have one drink, I am no longer responsible for my actions. I need people and treatment centers and hospitals and nurses to help me. I can't stop. And if I didn't get a hold of this soon, it was going to kill me. I had a monster in my brain, a monster who wanted to get me alone and convince me to have the first drink or pill. And then that monster would engulf me. Despite the partying, we were all pros on that movie and managed to turn out a huge crowd pleaser. Early notices for it were positive. One, in Variety magazine, read, "Bruce Willis will deliver the customers, but it's Matthew Perry who will attract the most attention in a pratfall-filled turn that bears comparison to what Tom Hanks was doing 12 to 15 years ago." This was high praise indeed for someone who looked up to Tom. Bruce hadn't been sure the film would work at all, and I'd bet him it would. If he lost, he had to do a guest spot on Friends. He's in 3 episodes of season 6. The whole nine yards became the number one movie in America for 3 weeks straight. I had done it. The dream I'd had since the 9th grade had finally come true. The whole nine yards was no Back to the Future, but Michael J. Fox and I are the only two people who have had the number one movie and the number one TV show at the same time. I should have been the toast of the town, but back in L.A., it was clear, at least to me, that my addiction had progressed to dangerous levels. I was at the point where I basically was unable to leave my house. Drugs and alcohol had completely taken over. I was so strung out on drugs and dealing with drug dealers that I couldn't even leave my bedroom. Instead of a grand moment of pure fame, dealing with the dealers was all I was doing. I showed up to the premiere of the movie, of course, and put on the Matthew Perry show, but I was bloated and driven by fear of something I did not understand. I've always had a dream of going on a talk show and being honest. Jay Leno. So, how you doing, Matthew? Me. Man, I just don't know which way is up. I'm totally screwed. I'm so miserable. I can't get out of bed. This would have been the perfect time for that. 4 years after The Whole Nine Yards, Bruce and I and Kevin shot a sequel, different director this time. If The Whole Nine Yards was the start of my movie stardom, it's fair to say that The Whole 10 Yards was the end. We shot the second movie in Los Angeles. We were given all too much freedom, and it sucked. You can seldom recreate a good thing, and it was true here. The jokes felt stale, the parties even staler. In fact, it was so bad that a while later I called my agents and said, I'm still allowed to go to movies though, right? When The Whole Nine Yards came out, I had been so mired in addiction I could barely leave my room. I had been in a hellhole of despair and demoralization, and my fucked up mind was slowly dragging my body down with it. Recently, it struck me, this type of feeling should have been reserved for when The Whole 10 Yards came out. Anyone in their right mind would have been beyond depressed after that one. Sometimes, at the end of the night, when the sun was just about to come up and everyone else had gone and the party was over, Bruce and I would just sit and talk. That's when I saw the real Bruce Willis. A good-hearted man, a caring man, selfless. A wonderful parent, and a wonderful actor. And most important, a good guy. And if he wanted me to be, I would be his friend for life. But as is the way with so many of these things, our paths rarely crossed after that. I, of course, pray for him every night now. Interlude. All heaven breaking loose. Something happened, and I relapsed. As I've said, to relapse, that's all it takes. Something, anything at all happening, good or bad. I was blowing yet another stretch of sobriety. I don't even remember why. I'd been thriving. I'd had 2 years. I was helping other men get sober, and I blew it over something so minute I can't even remember what it was. What I do remember is there was lots of drinking, lots of drugs, lots of isolation. I always used alone. I was afraid that if anybody saw how much I was doing, they would be horrified and try to get me to stop. But I had already started, so stopping was not an option. Something that has often saved my life is that I get scared. When I think things have gotten too out of control, I panic. Pick up the phone, and ask for help. That time, a sober companion and my wonderful father came to the rescue. They moved in immediately. I started to detox off the drugs that very day. I felt physically completely ruined, but the detox was going well. At least, that's what my dad and sober companion thought. What they didn't know was I had hidden a bottle of Xanax in my bedroom. This is what it's like to be an addict. You do things you never dreamed you'd do. My wonderful father had dropped everything to move in, to love and support me through one more self-created disaster, and I paid him back by hiding drugs in my nightstand? One night, I was so desperate for sleep, any kind of escape from the brutal detox I was going through. That bottle of Xanax was calling to me, an evil beacon in the darkness. I thought of it like a lighthouse, only in this case, I turned my boat toward the wrecking rocks, not away from them. The childproof bottle cap was no obstacle for this child. In the other room, that child's father dozed, watching reruns of Taxi, while in my room, by the metaphorical lethal cliffs, I dove into that bottle of Xanax and took four. One.